Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, two topics, if time permits. We're going to begin with the prosperity gospel of self and how the evangelical Christian media empire hijacked the Republican Party to bring us the Tea Party and Trump. My guest, Terry Heaton, H-E-A-T-O-N. Terry has recently retired after 28 years as a television executive producer, and he specialized in the media and propaganda. He is also recognized as a visionary iconoclast and an expert in web-related media and business. In the 1980s, Terry was an executive producer for the Christian Broadcasting Network, or CBN, and specifically the executive producer for televangelist Pat Robertson's 700 Club, which also led to his campaign work for Robertson's presidential run in 1988. Now, during that time, he was an insider into the Christian evangelical right's political maneuvering to usurp the Republican Party and dominate much of the media. And prior to his retirement in 2015, he was the senior vice president for audience research and development in Dallas. He hosts the popular POMPO blog, POMO, and which explores the deeper relationships between contemporary culture, media, religion, and postmodern society. He's written 7 books. His most recent is The Gospel of Self, How Jesus Joined the GOP, which outlines his insider activity and political intrigues in the Christian media. His website is thepomoblog.com. Nice to have you back with us, Terry.
It's great to be back, Gary.
I'd like to continue where we left off when you were last on our noon program last Thursday. And by the way, I invite my listeners to listen to that PRN archive later. You just go to PRN.fm and you go to the archives and you can hear it. I want to return to part of our conversation that concerns the modern evangelical movement, or what you've called the gospel of self, and others have called the prosperity gospel. Something you stated during our last conversation is that we must start to speak about religion and the role of religion in this country. And one of the characteristics of this political brand of Christianity, and we can include this Dominionist sect that Sarah Palin represents, is that it perceives us as the supreme faith, that anyone who wants to be saved after death must embrace it. And during the past election, the rise of the Tea Party before it, anti-Islamic sentiments increased dramatically. I believe it's fair to say that one of the major threats to the world today is religious fundamentalism, whether for theological, social, or political reasons. And this has been based upon a strict literal interpretation of a faith's scriptures or the holy books. And while we often associate this form of fundamentalist scriptural agenda with Islam, it's also present in Judaism and nationalist Hinduism in India, and it's certainly present in many American evangelical communities. And there are probably many reasons for this in fundamentalism in the Christianity right movement today, and a lack of education in biblical history, and a lack of critical thinking skills that perpetuates myths and legends and stories that are questionable at best and not historical. In fact, since I do a lot of debating on this program, we had one of the most significant religious scholars in the world on Christianity here, a professor of religion at a major university, Duke University. And I asked him a basic question. Here was my question. Can you prove that the Bible is the Word of God? Can you prove that every word in it should be interpreted literally? Why were no women authors of books in the Bible that was selected? Why did the Catholic Church exclude numerous, over 24 books from the Bible? Why were the Gnostic texts not considered important enough to go in the Bible? how political is the Bible? And why is it that people don't realize it was written over 1,000 years? And if you were to go back in time to a particular date in a particular area of the world where someone who would author a book of the Bible lived, you would first have to understand, who is this person? What is their perception of life? What relationship do they have with their faith to women in their lives, to other people, to other religions, to other beliefs? And if that person were to continue to be alive today, would they have evolved? It's amazing, because certain religious sects are, they stop their growth at the point where there was a radical shift in the direction of their religion. They're wearing the same clothes that were worn in the 1600s, as if there were no more truths after 1600. So when I look at the Bible, I have to ask myself, is it a book to be taken literally? Is it a book to be taken allegorically? Is it a book that I can choose to be inspired by selecting those parts that I believe are important as metaphors for how we could live our life and inspirations? Can I choose to reject those that are based upon a misogynist God that would demean that which he supposedly was imperfect in creating? And why would a God make a rule where he creates, with no intervention of anyone else, a woman, and then calls the woman flawed and has the followers believe that a woman who has a period is flawed and casts her into a negative position? And I don't think that we have very smart people historically studying the religious text, because if we're going to be motivated, then should we be motivated by one single principle? And that is a higher sense of ethics and spiritual harmonizing with other people in this world to base life upon what is sacred. And that's not what I find in most religions today, nor their leaders, depending upon who's leading and what their current message is. Those are my own thoughts, and those are personal, and those are subjective. But I'd like to start with someone who has spent, as you have, what would be considered not only a full career, but an extended career at the very heart, in the control room, in the war room of that movement. The form is yours. Take your time.
Well, you said an awful lot, and I have a lot in response to that. I think first of all, you're spot on, and let's just, you know, for grins, you know, consider this, that in the world of news anyway, and I'm talking about how all of this has influenced the culture within which we live today. The world of news as a word, and it's an important word. It's news. It is by default progressive, because it talks about things that are new. And the conservative world, on the other hand, talks about things that are old. So the best that they can do is produce a product that is olds. So you're talking about news versus olds. And I don't think we see things that way, and we really should, because that's exactly the conflict that's taking place. And it is huge, as you say. I think, you know, I go back to, I do a lecture on the 15th century in Western Europe, and the incredible changes that took place during that time, and with regards to religion. And there are a couple of things. There's a character named John Wycliffe that I'm sure you're familiar with, and probably your listeners too, because Wycliffe, his significance in history is that he is the man who created the first common English language version of the Bible. Up until that time, it was held exclusively in the hands of the priests of the church at Rome. And so in their hands, since people based their lives on that book back then, the priests in Rome had tremendous power within the culture. So Wycliffe challenged that directly by translating the Bible from the Latin to into common English. And then when the printing press came along, that was a huge disruption in culture because the Bible was the first book that was printed. And so the power structure at the time, the Roman Church, had a fit. And, you know, they tried to license printing presses, very similar to what people are trying to do today to license the media. And so, you know, it all failed. And eventually, there was a great quote from a priest who says, "The jewel of the laity is in the hand, excuse me, the jewel of the elites is in the hands of the laity." And so that's what we have today, is that the Bible is available in many different translations for everybody to read. And I feel that a good way to look at that is that the Bible is a message from history to me. It's not a message from history or the Word of God to be given to somebody else to determine how it impacts me. And so, you know, that was the essential revolution that took place in the 15th century, because people could read. In fact, Wycliffe is the one who said, "This book shall make possible government of the people, by the people, and for the people." And that's a very important understanding, because if everybody had access to the Bible, they could, you know, govern themselves. And, you know, I don't think we've actually gotten to that place, because, you know, hierarchies always seem to step in and mess things up. But that's a very important concept. And, you know, today we've got the same thing. You've got the internet is whacking the sacred cows of the institutions of America and, well, the institutions of the West. And, you know, every one of them is complaining, you know, and they're saying that the jewel of the elites or the jewel of the institutions is now in the hands of the laity. So, you know, I kind of think of what's going on essentially as very good, although we're certainly going through some very rough times, and I think those are going to continue. I think everybody is going to squawk, every institution is going to squawk, and, you know, we'll just see where it goes. And so in terms of, you know, your understanding there, I think it's, you know, another question I would ask about the guy from the early church would be, what books was he reading that helped shape his worldview? And that word worldview is a biggie today, because you've got these people with the gospel of self who are proclaiming a biblical worldview for their followers. And, you know, I say again, Gary, that we have just got to talk about religion in our culture, and especially today. I think, you know, the whole thing that holds, you know, Trump's support in place is their religious convictions. And or what they've been taught should be their religious conviction. So, you know, we can talk about words, we can talk about, you know, ignorance, and we can talk about, you know, Trump being this, that, or the other thing. And it's not going to make any difference in his support unless and until we can talk about the religion that is behind it.
I appreciate that overview. Thank you. And if you would, I want you to extend the concept of the political underpinnings of this particular Christian theology of self and prosperity, because I see that the people who are most prosperous are the people who are running the churches, not their congregation. In fact, I have seen preachers explain to their congregation the justification for a $65 million jet. And then I heard a actually saw a YouTube of an interview of two leading televangelists talking about how they cannot communicate with God in flying in coach, that they have to be close to the heavens. And I'm thinking, what reasonable person would believe that nonsense? And yet their congregations do, and their congregations, some of these are huge congregations with 20,000 members. And many of these people are middle class, working class, and poor. So what is the psychological association between people who have a completely political and economic agenda and using their Christian theology of self and prosperity as the rationalization to motivate or in some way inspire people who are never going to have that? It's never going to trickle down to them. It's never going to be shared with them. And keep them coming back each week to hear the same message about how they have to give so that this whole organization can continue to increase and rise and have more of everything, but not for them. Where is that disconnect? Your thoughts?
Yeah, that I think that's the $64,000 question. And but it's really not. Gosh, there's so much to say here. I think, first of all, yes, it's never going to happen for them. I agree with that completely. And so for all practical purposes, these people are supporting what's not in their best interests. And that's the real, you know, the real pickle that we've gotten ourselves into with regards to the gospel of self. But what the gospel of self teaches is that, you know, God, life itself, is for you and wants you to prosper. And if he wants you to prosper, then he wants your believer brothers and sisters to prosper. And isn't it great when certain of those believers, you know, have an abundance of things, because after all, they are, you know, they're paying tithes, they're paying, you know, they're supporting ministries, they're doing all this good work, you know. And I mean, at the 700 Club, we divided givers into categories based upon how much they gave. You know, the 700 Club was basically, back then it was 25 cents a day. It was like $18 a month. And, you know, everybody, we knew, you know, scientifically what percentage of new 700 Club members would then go on to be 1,000 Club members, where they would give $1,000 in a year. And we knew what percentage of 1,000 Club members would then go on to be 2,500 Club members, and the percentage of those that would go on to be Founders Club members. And so in a very interesting and strategic way, you can actually forecast income or forecast revenue based upon, you know, the dissecting of people's giving. And, you know, we knew what words were necessary, what statements were necessary. And like I say in the book, it is an expanding circle. People give to the 700 Club, Pat told me, for these reasons and in this order. How does it help me? How does it help my family? How does it help my community? How does it help my neighborhood? How does it help my state? How does it help the country? And then how does it help somebody else? So if you played those strings very carefully, you know, using the right words and the right images and the right stories, you would build people's faith in a version of the gospel that is really a heresy, and a great one at that. So, once people buy into that, it's very, very hard to, you know, get people not to think that way. So, you know, as much as they cling to their faith in Jesus or their faith in God, you know, and their salvation. They are clinging to their beliefs that this gospel is really about them being, you know, better, about the betterment of themselves, their families, etc. And so, you know, it's pretty hard to argue against that, no matter what you see, because you're clinging to that as the basis for what's going to make you prosperous. And so, you know, the other things that go on with it, you know, don't really matter in the minds of these people. And here's the thing, Gary, and this is so important. This is not ignorance. You know, this is more brainwashing. And, you know, and it's done very subtly and very carefully. And it's actually genius in a certain sense. But I find, you know, these kinds of people to be generally wonderful. It's just that when I start talking with them about what it is they believe, especially politically, they get very, very uncomfortable. And that's why I think we really need to be talking to people about Christianity, about, you know, and I think it's actually news. And, you know, it belongs in a discussion that doesn't, you know, cast aspersions on people's character.
I want to take that a little further, Terry. Have you ever heard of Herbert W. Armstrong?
Sure.
I grew up in a small conservative Christian community, went to the Baptist Church, First Christian Church, Parkersburg, West Virginia, as junior deacon, and the reason I went to church is because I liked the preacher. But I was also very curious, and thank goodness for my mother, because I would frequently make inappropriate comments, not vulgar. We didn't do that. We had manners. But I was just curious, and she said, never stop asking questions if you feel that you need an answer. So one day in church, and I raised my hand. Now, of course, no one ever raised their hand in church, ever. Right. And I could hear people go, oh, no, no, no. Why didn't Blandina leave that kid at home? And so finally the preacher looked over and says, yes, Gary. I said, well, up there is this big picture of Jesus. Now, I'm 10 years old at the time. I said, if Jesus, you know, is Jesus white, where do all the black people come from? Now, that's a legitimate question for a young kid, right? You want to know stuff. You want to know something. And he was very patient. He also was an athlete, because he was an athlete, we'd play football and, you know, and basketball and box. You liked him as a human being. And because you could relate with him as a human being, you didn't have to first accept the rituals and gestures and the language. You simply had a human being talking with someone who was naive and not knowledgeable about the world but wanted to know. And then I said, he always asked me, because my mom worked for the church. My mom was his secretary for 30 years. And so he would say, Gary Michael, why I see you leaving off the side back there. Where are you going? I'd tell the truth. I said, well, the music here is very boring. So I get down to the Black Baptist Church on Clay Street because they have great music and everybody sings. And they just have we're very conservative. We just sit here in a pew, on a hard wooden pew, and they've got these wonderful outfits on, and everybody's getting up there and dancing. And I love that. So I grew up first indoctrinated into gospel music, but old South gospel music. My family come from North Carolina, Kentucky, Virginia, finally West Virginia. So I had that love of that kind of music and rhythm, and also the type of testimonials. Because, you know, in the Black Baptist Church, at least where I grew up, people get up and give their testimonies about how they're doing with Jesus. And right. And you'd have a, can we hear it for her? Can we hear it for her? And then everybody else. In our church, no one said a word at any time. And they were such hypocrites. They'd get up and go outside. And the moment they're outside, they're gossiping. So my introduction to religion was with a person I could relate to. Then on the radio, I think it was on Sunday night, Herbert W. Armstrong came on, and he was as much of a progressive about religion and its teachings as I've ever heard. And I didn't get the idea that you had to, you know, be rich or seek rich or seek prosperity in order to understand some of the lessons he was teaching. Now, again, I'm young, I'm naive, I'm not worldly, never saw a building higher than six stories in Parkersburg. And it was only when I went out of there that I started to see other beliefs and other values. So that brings me to this. When you have people who really want to instill a sense of true spiritual values, and all religions should be based upon spiritual values, then why wouldn't the teachings be, okay, here's the minister, or here's the rabbi, or here's the imam? And the leading imam in the entire New York area is a close friend of mine, and Ibrahim Malik. And you get up and you say, okay, what are we going to do to show that we love other people, other races, those who suffer? Why don't we go out and do the following? Let's go in and de-ghettoize that building. Let's help these homeless people. Let's take in some people. We got extra clothes. Give those clothes to those people. Let's put together some money and get some kids who are big sisters and big brothers to be able to go to college, because we're going to, all of us working together, we're going to form a scholarship and give them scholarships. And let's bring these people onto our blocks to show that we're not afraid of a person who is poor white or poor black or poor Latino or any other color. And this way, we are doing good work. Now, whether you call it God's work or whether you call it your spiritual work, at least you're showing each week by action, by virtue of self, that you are what you do. And quite frankly, I don't see that happening, especially in the Christianity. Instead, what I see is more and more of this manipulation to get particular powerful people, the Republicans and conservatives more often than not, into positions within the administrations. Doesn't matter whether it's which administration, they all now have this association because they want those religious votes. Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama was no different than George Bush Sr. or Jr. or Trump. They cater to these people. But what are you wanting if you cater to them? And then you find out, gee whiz, they support Israel without any question. Now, I support Israel's right to exist. I support every Israeli's right to live in peace and harmony and never fear a terrorist bombing. But I equally support, at equal measure, the Palestinians' right not to live in an apartheid state, not to be bombed into oblivion, not to live with such degradation of standard of living that many die because of that. I want to see peace for both. Well, that's not what I see. I see a very pro-Zionist religious right, and Obama was no different, supporting the people in power. And if anything, these are the people that have some of the most non-spiritual values I've ever seen in the Likud and the Netanyahu's group. And yet you won't hear a peep, not one word, not one syllable said in the entire religious movement in America against the corruption of spiritual values in those in power in Israel, for example. And yet you have one of the largest peace movements in the world per country, per population in Israel. We have nothing like that in the United States. Nothing. Your thoughts, please.
Well, I agree with everything you said there. I have a Palestinian family. My oldest daughter is married to a Palestinian. They live in Amman, Jordan with my four grandkids four of my grandkids. And so my window on the world in that whole region is very different than my contemporaries. And, I went to visit them in 2006, and Wasim, my son-in-law, was, you know, he told me all kinds of stories, including he said, you know, there are groups of settlers who drive around in cars with guns and shoot and kill Palestinians you know, without any particular reason. And I said, well, no, that can't possibly be. Because I would have heard something about that if that was true. So I, when I went back home, I called a friend of mine who, you know, I worked with in the news business, and he had been the bureau chief, one of the bureau chiefs for NBC News in Israel. And I asked him the question, and he said, well, of course that exists. And I said, well, why don't you do stories about it? And he says, we do, and they get spiked in New York. So that event really opened my eyes, and I started looking at things, and I have a very different view of Israel. And, you know, it has become a central part of my study of evangelical Christianity, because, you know, first of all, to the evangelists themselves, the idea that Jesus is coming back soon is a powerful motivation that they can use to tell their story to Christians of all stripes. And so, you know, there's no reason to not actually participate in events that would signal the return of Christ, because, you know, this is to their advantage and the advantage of their ministries, and to the growth of their ministries, and obviously to the growth of funds that then allow them to be more powerful and to do more things in this world instead of the other one. So, Chuck Colson was a dear friend of mine, and he wrote lots of books, but one of them called Kingdoms in Conflict, and the foreword to that book is about a 70-page story about an evangelical president of the United States and the people around him during a crisis in Jerusalem, when a radical right-wing element of the Jews decides it's time to take over the Temple Mound and to rebuild the temple. And the story is utterly fascinating, and it is frightening beyond belief. And Colson knew that there are people out there and who call themselves Christians who are willing to help things along because they want Jesus to come back, and they think that 1948 signaled a change in that whole scene, and that was fulfillment of biblical prophecy, and the Messiah is going to return. Moreover, in 1967, when the Jews got Jerusalem, that was even more. And so they dare not say anything against Israel. And that is a great weakness of these evangelical Christian types. But it's very hard to get the press to look seriously at it. I mean, they think it's too complicated, and, you know, it's just...
They're just afraid. Terry,
oh, I know they're afraid.
Let me tell you something.
Absolutely.
I was on ABC Radio Network and WNABC for 12 years, and I had the most popular rated show in the history of ABC Radio before or after. No one's touched those numbers since. It was number one in America on Sunday evenings. And so I asked, and I was told just directly from a top management person that you don't say anything ever that could be construed as criticism of Israel, or the next minute on my cell phone, I'll get all these calls from AIPAC and these lobbyists. They have tentacles everywhere. And so the media doesn't touch us because the media doesn't want to be, let's say, in any way affected, so they self-censor. Now, here's something people should know. I had an opportunity after being on WMCA, after my ABC tenure, which I left. I went right down the block on 57th Street to WMCA, where I started my professional commercial radio broadcasting career. I walked in middle of the afternoon. I just said goodbye to ABC, and I asked the station manager and the program director, would you like me to come over and do a show here? Under what terms? I said, 5 days a week live in the evening, 2 hours, 8 to 10, and then rebroadcast the best of those shows on Saturday and Sunday. And they came to terms with me, the whole thing under a half hour. And so the following Monday, I started. Now, I was on there for 3 hours. Following me was Alan Combs, who passed just about 4 or 5 months ago for 2 hours. And then Barry Farber, who is, I think he's one of the two oldest broadcasters staying on the radio for over 55 or 60 years. And he's still alive, still broadcasting, by the way, in his late 80s, and a nice man. He did the overnight. And 3 years after that, we got a call, and the station had been sold to the Christian Broadcasting Network. And I had a meeting, and here's what the conversation went like. We'd like to have you and your audience stay. You have the largest audience in America at night, and we just like, and I said, I'm very appreciative of that. I said, how many stations do you have? He said, oh, I think they said at the time over 300. What it actually was, I can't verify, and how many it is today, I can't verify. But let me give the audience an example of how big Christian broadcasting is. If you took ABC, NBC, CBS, and CNN, put them together with Fox, it's still bigger. They have more. They have. I mean, you're talking about huge audience. I mean, it is mega times bigger than anything else in regular radio. It's like PBS. If you think PBS is not big, understand they have over, last time I asked, it was 135 stations, excuse me, 335 stations. What it is today, I don't know, more or less. But you're talking about a network that's larger than ABC, CBS, NBC, CNN, and Fox combined. Right. And so here's the question that I finally decided to leave rather than stay. And I went over to WEBD, which was a Jewish station. And I was on there until they were sold to ESPN about 13 years later. I ask, I don't just talk about nutrition. I also talk about the environment. I talk about history. I have a program called Conversations with the Remarkable Minds, where some of the greatest thinkers on the planet come to sit for an hour. And I said, and many times these people challenge some of the both political and religious ideologies of the day, and would that be allowed? And there was this pause. And the answer was, talk about health, great. Talk about anything else, not great. And and so that was it. So rather than censor, I said goodbye, and about 3 months later, moved on. They're very conscious of controlling the message. So right. here's the issue. In America today, part of our problem, not all, part, is that we have been indoctrinated from Edward Bernays clear up till the present day in honoring the brand. So the brand is what we are exposed to. And within that brand, at different times, at different transitions, there are personalities. And so we can remember some personalities, Arthur Godfrey and Ed Sullivan and the Ted Mack Amateur Hour, sponsored by, you know, that iron supplement. And people come and go, even though at times we think that the personality is the brand. Let me give you a reality check. If you think the personality is the brand, then Ailes would still be on Fox running it as he created it, and Bill O'Reilly, their number one personality, would still be there. And in a blink of an eye, for indiscretions that wouldn't be acceptable and shouldn't be acceptable anywhere, they're both gone. The brand right. stays. They go. When corporations were purchasing, and I have a word for it, I made up a word called economic genocidalists. Now, the right and left are both equally vulnerable to being participants. An economic genocidalist is a person that defines themselves as either liberal or conservative, either Republican or Democrat, though those are meaningless terms today. Right. And what they do is they'll go in and look at a company, find its vulnerabilities, buy that company, strip off its assets, bleed it dry, get it into bankruptcy and get it out so that all the debt no longer exists, but they still have it, they can rebuild, or they sell it. What they really cared about was the brand, because that factory employing 2,000 people in Flint, Michigan, or that brick factory down in Parkersburg, West Virginia, that employed 500 people for 100 years, that's not important. The brand is. So if they can make bricks in China at half the price that can be made here with no labor problems, no unions, no environmental issues, and bring that brick back in the United States, as people have done with steel and other and dresses. I would just walk today through the garment industry. I remember when the garment industry used to be packed. It was one of the largest employers in New York City. And today I see all these empty buildings, all these offices empty, because why, in their minds, we're going to buy your company. But why should we pay a union garment industry worker $32 an hour plus so much vacation and plus health care when we can have that made for 14 cents an hour in Bangladesh, bring it back in, the big designers will buy it, they can get 300 to 400% markup instead of 50%, and so it's the brand. So in religion, what you have is you can have televangelists come and go, but the brand never changes. So they protect the brand at all costs. And people don't realize how susceptible we are to being a part of a brand or to branding. Could you take us through that?
Well, certainly. I mean, you said an awful lot, and I agree with you again. I think I find Edward Bernays to be one of the most destructive people in all of history. And, you know, I've studied that Creel Commission and the Creel Committee, excuse me, and Bernays and Walt Lippmann and people like that. But exactly. I mean, we practiced branding, and because we were so good at it and had such a terrific audience, we were actually, I think, able to shift the brand of Christianity to the right. And, you know, because the most, when you think of Christian today, you know, just as a, you know, a generic institution, you know, it's going to conjure up things from the right wing before it does anything else. And that's a shame. And there are a lot of people in the church who, in positions of leadership, who realize that this has happened. And so there's a very interesting, you know, movement underway behind the scenes. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see what happens with that in the years ahead. But in terms of the rules of branding and how you know, apply those to a product, you know, that we were experts in that. I mean, we were, you know, the 700 Club and CBN was genius level marketing, because that's what we did, that we used, you know, the tricks innovated by Bernays and all of his, you know, the Mad Men era, you name it. We knew what we were doing, you know, and we had producers who were damn good at creating images and to fleshing out the brand, if you will. The one thing I want to point out about, you know, the personality versus the brand is that all of these evangelical big ministries, whether they're on television or not, it's interesting how they become family businesses rather than, you know, just a Christian brand. So, you know, that whole interesting thing is interesting to talk about, because, you know, the assumption that the genes of the father are going to be, you know, present and, you know, make the same differences and be able to do the same things as the father, I think it's laughable. And, you know, and I ran into that, you know, several times in my career at CBN. So, you know, I get what you're saying, but I will also say that the 700 Club is a personality driven television program. And that personality is Pat Robertson. Even now, when he's not, you know, and God knows they need to get him off of there permanently. But when he's not there, it's just not the same. And, you know, that was a big problem that I struggled with when he was running for president. But anyway, I think the brand has been shifted to the evangelical message that, you know, the Catholics, I mean, good grief. You were talking about, I think you said Friday about the book of James, about faith without works is dead. But, you know, Pat used to always say that Luther thought that James was the book of straw. And that's because Luther's message, or a version of Luther's message, the just shall live by faith, is at the very core of this whole evangelical movement, that your behavior doesn't matter as much as your faith. But to me, you know, faith is your behavior. I mean, that you can't separate the two. And so, as to what are we going to do about the brand? I think that we have to let other voices into the discussion, and there are some terrific authors out there now who are writing about the sacraments versus the just shall live by faith and the whole business of the church. Like, the church can't save everybody, you know, they can't feed all of the poor, but they can feed some. And, it's like, I can't take care of everybody, but I can take care of somebody. And so this whole movement that's taking place in the universe, as it were, around us today, with all of the nonsense that we're dealing with, I think that, you know, I've always been very, positive when it comes to the things that a networked group of people can accomplish. And, it's not going to be easy. And, you know, institutions are going to crumble, and their high priests are going to, piss and moan. But somehow, some way, we're going to win in this. And, I don't view the future through purely dystopian eyes, although I wouldn't call myself a utopian either. I just feel more positive. I feel we're going through things that, frankly, we have to go through, that if we didn't go through them, it would just fester and fester and fester, and I don't think we'd go anywhere. So, Chinese say... interesting times, and I think we are.
Terry, I have one final question, but it's take it wherever you can.
All right.
I want you to explain to us the politicalization of the Christian theology that you and your colleagues were involved with the Christian Broadcasting Network, and what were the primary social and civil issues that were being targeted, and if you could also speak about the evangelical right managing to successfully marginalize the Democratic Party and the left based upon framing right-left differences in moral rhetoric. And when I think back upon it, it was a brilliant strategy that later brought both Bush and Trump into office. What was the strategy, and can you give us some examples of how certain issues were interpreted as moral combats between good and evil?
Certainly. And I have... Good God, I could write a book on this alone. I think, we chose emotional issues. And again, when your base core assumption is the gospel of self, it's what are the things, with individuals that are going to be hot buttons? Well, you know, certainly finances was one. You know, so how could we, you know, help improve people's finances? And that was a very easy way to move from to grasp certain issues or certain thoughts from the Bible and move them into a Republican Party conservative perspective. So, you know, people's finances is certainly one. I think obviously morality is a big one. But it's interesting to me that you know, that the issues, the moral issues like abortion. Abortion is not about it's not about murdering babies. It's about controlling people's, you know, sexual habits. If it isn't, then why don't conservatives support birth control? Well, they don't because, you know, they're not really pro-life. They're not really anti-abortion as much as they are, you know, we really need to fix this problem of too much screwing going on in the United States. That's the real issue. So when you can take moral issues, you know, especially those where people feel that their version of religion carries a certain moral superiority, well, then you've got something you can sell that moves people to the right. So the conservative position on abortion, you know, it's an easy sell, frankly. And when you combine that with, you know, financial help and, you know, personal responsibility that goes with the personal relationship with Jesus, well, it's easy to take, you know, Christian people, believers, especially faith believers, you know, those who are indoctrinated into the gospel of self, it's easy to take them and put them into the conservative political positions. That doesn't make them, you know, any more, it doesn't make the Republican Party any more Christian. In fact, I took time to study the platforms of both the Republican and Democratic parties this year, and you know, honestly, the party of the Democratic Party platform reads a whole lot more like the red words in the Bible than certainly the Republican Party. So, you know, a strong defense, small government, and especially, you know, not letting those leeches take money away from you, you know, so that they can be lazy. I mean, those are messages that resonate with that particular version of Christianity. So, you know, it wasn't very hard. It was just, it just took, you got to keep hammering on these particular points, and that's what people will care about because you tell them they need to care about it. And then suddenly their political position gets completely wrapped up with their religious beliefs. And then you've got a real problem because people are not going to separate from that easily. And, you know, fortunately, you know, if you look at the Pew numbers about, you know, religion, you see that the fastest growing faith in the United States is actually no faith. It's I heard a number that from the Baptist Church that they were losing in excess of 80% of their kids by the time they turned 18. Well, those are things that aren't really talked about a lot in the press. You know, why are young people bolting? You know, why do people like David Hayward from The Lasting Supper, why is he, you know, making such inroads with people? You know, people are leaving the church and looking for something else. Then you've got the whole emergent group and Brian McLaren, and people are just searching. They want to be, you know, Christians. They want to be, you know, involved in the church, but you know, they can't stand the hypocrisy and the language that's coming from the Christian right today. And so,
Terry, we're out of time. We're out of time. But young kids today don't want to be preached to. They've got way too much information at their disposal that many of us didn't have in the past. They want ethical and spiritual values. They just don't want the religious dogma and the pragmatic teaching that it was based upon. They see the incompleteness and they in the body politic of religions, and they also see the completeness of the human spirit. It's a completely different generation and different values, and the church is going to end up with very, very few young people. And that's to their own concern. I thank you for coming on today and sharing your insights about the gospel of self, how Jesus joined the GOP. Very insightful for us, Terry. Thank you very much, and I look forward to another conversation.
You're welcome.
Terry Heaton, H-E-A-T-O-N. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Have a nice day.
There's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, Father, we don't need escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love and get here today. Oh, picket lines and picket signs, don't punish me with brutality. Sister, talk to me, sister, so you can see. Sister. Oh.